Luke chapter 21. Again, if you're visiting, we just teach through the whole thing. We finished off in Luke chapter 21, verse 4. So we'll be picking up in verse 5. Yes, that's a nod to turn on the air conditioning. Yeah, there we go. He's been looking for a sign. He's trying to get signals up, and I'm short of having flags. I'm trying to get him to... There we go. See how that works? Luke chapter 21, verse 5. And this is, again, remember the context. This is in the week before the crucifixion. He's had the triumphal entry. He's come in. He's cleaned out the temple. He has been examined in the same way that the worshipers would bring their lamb into the priest, and the lamb would inspect it to see if there were any spot or blemish. The religious leaders spent time examining Christ to see if they could find fault with him, peppering him with questions. You had the Pharisees asking him questions, the Sadducees, the various groups, and he answered all of them so that they marveled and didn't dare to ask him any more questions. And he actually asked a few of them that they could not answer or would not. And then we ended last week in the beginning of chapter 21, where he was watching people bring their money into the treasury. And he saw a poor widow casting in two mites, which is the smallest amount you could give. And he said, of a truth, in verse 3, I say unto you that this poor widow has cast in more than they all. For all these have their abundance cast into the offerings of God, but she of her penury or her poverty has cast in all her living that she had. All the living, literally all her life is what it says underneath. And so, apparently, in the context of that, people giving And of course, he had said in other places that there were those who would give, and they would blow a trumpet before they give, and they'd make a big show of how much money they were dumping into the coffers. And it says this in verse 5. And as some spake of the temple, how it was adorned with goodly stones and gifts, he said, as for these things which you behold, the days will come in the which there shall not be left one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down. Now the temple at this point was tremendous. It was started, there was the first temple, there was Solomon's temple that was built that was amazing, and then now it was destroyed. And the second temple came along, Zerubbabel's temple. And that was then renovated by Herod the Great. He started it around 19 BC. Herod the Great was a short little guy, he's about 4 foot 8, and he, I think maybe partially to compensate for his size, I don't know, he wanted to be something, and he wanted to be remembered as something, and he was known for doing some tremendous architecture, doing different projects. He decided he was going to build the Jews a temple, which at first they weren't really all that cool with, because they were afraid that he was going to just decimate the one that was there and then start over again, which they didn't want. But he did it in such a way that there was no interruption in temple service when he rebuilt this thing. And remember now, Rome and Herod the Great was overseeing that area. Rome was oppressing Israel. They had conquered them. And the idea of Roman government building a temple to their god wasn't anything that they would readily accept. Yet, even the Jews, we were told historically, you look at the documents, said of the day, if you haven't seen Herod's temple, you've never seen a building, because it was phenomenal. The stones that were used for this, all of them cut off-site and brought in, fit together without mortar, some of them weighing literally hundreds of tons that would just fit together so closely that you couldn't even jam a knife or a piece of paper in between the stones. No mortar, just one on top of another. All of the work done. In fact, part of it, he actually took 1,000, Josephus, the historian, tells us, he took like 1,000 Levites and trained them in the art of stonemasonry so that there would be men of God that would be working on this building, on the sections that needed to be worked on. Gold was everywhere on this. The top of it was all gold. The thing was white, such, and it's set up on the mount, on Temple Mount, so that you almost couldn't look at it in the sun. And it was a tremendous building. He started it in 19 BC. It didn't get finished until 63 AD. Around the time of Jesus being in here, if this was in the 30s, 32 AD, somewhere in there, this had been worked on for about 50 years at this point. And even after Herod the Great was dead, they continued to work on it until 63 AD. It was a fabulous building. It was one of the most. He wanted to create something that would compete with the great pyramids of Egypt. He wanted to build an edifice. And yeah, it was to Jews and to their God, but it was also for Herod the Great because he wanted to be known by this thing. And so in the middle of that, they're looking at it, and we come to what they call, I guess, the Olivet Discourse. There is a section in Matthew 24 that's a parallel account. There is Mark chapter 13, I believe, is the same thing, although there are some who say that what's described here in Luke is a different event than those other two because there are some mild differences. I'm not convinced of that one way or the other, but certainly they're looking at the temple, and the people are showing him this monstrous structure that is fabulous beyond all compare. He doesn't seem particularly impressed with that. You know, he looks at that building, he looks at the gold, he looks at the shiny stuff, and he says, you know, the days will come in the which there shall not be left one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down. And when they hear that, they immediately ask him, Master, when shall these things be, and what sign will there be when these things shall come to pass? When you look at the other two accounts, they ask him, when shall these things be? What will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? Because they look at the massiveness of this structure, and they think it would have to be the end of the world that would take this out. There's nothing that, I mean, you think about a stone, and you know, this isn't a day of bulldozers and dynamite. This is when stones were moved by hand, drugged by sleds and animals and rollers. And him saying that this stuff, not one stone's going to be left on top of another, it is unthinkable to them. Now, again, for Jesus, he's not particularly impressed because although the building is phenomenal to look at, it really was a wonder, it was more the people's hearts that he was concerned with. In Matthew 15, verse 7, he said to the religious leaders, he said, you hypocrites, well did Isaiah prophesy of you, saying, this people draweth nigh unto me with their mouth and honoreth me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. But in vain they do worship me, teaching for doctrines the commandments of men. And regardless of how impressive the outward appearance of the religion is, in God's eyes it's vain, it's empty, if it's just motions and ritual and the doctrines of men rather than the commandments of God. You know, we look at the church today by and large, and certainly, you know, the Catholic Church is all about pomp and circumstance. You know, you see the gilding and the robes and the chants, but it's not just them. You know, there's a whole side of Orthodox Christianity that is also has the trappings and the choir robes. Even, you know, you turn on the Christian Comedy Channel or TBN and look at that, and for some reason everything's got to be gold. The stage is gilded. You know, everybody's wearing the nicest suits, and yet God isn't terribly impressed with that. You know, for me, I mean, we're working on this building. We've been working on this building for just about a year now, I think. And, you know, you come in and little things bug you. If you're in here all the time, I mean, one hand, I can come in here and being here when the timbers were ripped out and remembering what's underneath the walls and the floors and all that, you know, it gives you a different perspective. But you can come in here and you can walk in and I can see, you know, little stuff we missed, little mistakes we made. You see where the little kid went nuts with a crayon in the bathroom upstairs, and you go, oh, you know, we spent how many hours on those walls, and somebody's just, ah. But yet, you know, the truth is the building is really not all that important in the whole scheme of things. The outward appearance is not. It's more about the heart. And the Lord is much more concerned with, are we faithful to do what he's called us to do here inside? Are we growing in grace and in the knowledge of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, as Peter told us to do? Because if that's not going on, the rest of it really doesn't matter. You know, truly, when you look at the church going all the way back, you know, the Catholic tradition is that Peter was the first pope, and, you know, the succession was made all the way down through the line. If you think about who Christ picked for his disciples, they were a bunch of fishermen. They were a bunch of common guys. Peter always saying the wrong thing at the wrong time. You know, and to think about all of these rituals and rites and these rehearsed prayers, I don't see that in Peter. I don't see that in Jesus. I don't see that in any of the disciples. I see an open, honest relationship with God. In fact, Jesus came on the scene and starts talking about God as our Father, which is something that was revolutionary at the time because Nobody had done that. He was the Lord. He was God. They wouldn't even say his name. They were so reverent for him. And yet, Jesus starts talking about you can cry, Abba, Father. You know, you can call him Daddy. And that's the type of relationship he's looking for, not an impressive structure. I mean, certainly, you know, sometimes the Lord has done great things. He did command a temple to be built by Solomon, and it was a tremendous thing. But yet, that's never to shadow the relationship part. Now, the interesting thing is Jesus says, not one stone's going to be left on another. About 40 years later, in 70 AD, Titus Vespasian besieged Rome, Jerusalem, and he took the city, and he took great care, but he did not want the temple destroyed. He wanted to keep it. Some people think he wanted to turn it into a pagan temple, but it was because of the building that it was, and it was an amazing structure, he did not want that destroyed, and it was a horrible siege. We'll get into it more as we get further down into the chapter, but at one point, they managed to break through the walls, they broke through the lines, and one of the soldiers threw a torch in through the wall in through the window of the temple, and it caught fire, and the walls and everything were wood overlaid with gold, and once it started burning, it got hot, it got really hot. It got so hot that all of the gold that was up on the spires and the roof and everything melted down in between the stones, and so the Roman soldiers literally pried every single stone apart to get scrape the gold off that was in between. And so Jesus, 40 years in the future, could see as clear as a bell that not one stone was going to be left on another, which was unthinkable to them at the time. The thing for us to take note of that is, if he can see 40 years in the future, he can see 2,000 years in the future, as clear as a bell. And so as we go through this, he's going to give some things talking about what's going to happen in the near future for them when Jerusalem would be besieged and the Jews would be kicked out. But he's also going to be talking about the end of the age and his return. And so, you know, we can look to what he says and take that with all certainty that he knows what he's talking about. So they asked him in verse 7, saying, Master, but when shall these things be? And what sign will there be when these things shall come to pass? And he said in verse 8, Take heed that you be not deceived. For many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and the time draweth near. Go you not therefore after them. Interesting, and when you look at the accounts, again, in Matthew 24 and Mark 13, I think it is, all three of them have that same phrase. The first thing he says when they want to know, when are you coming back? He says, take heed that you be not deceived. Because the last days are going to be marked by deception. Paul told Timothy in 2 Timothy 3, he said, This know also, that in the last days perilous times shall come. For men shall be lovers of their own selves, covetous, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, without natural affection, truce breakers, false accusers, incontinent, fierce, despisers of those that are good, traitors, heady, high-minded, lovers of pleasure, more than lovers of God, having a form of godliness, but denying the power thereof. From such turn away. And he's saying, you know, in the same way that even in their day, the religious leaders were hypocrites in that they had the appearance of being holy, but internally they were far separated. In the same way, in the last days, there are going to be many who have the appearance of being religious, which they are religious, but there's no relationship. And he goes on in that chapter and he goes through some more stuff. And then he says in 2 Timothy 3:13, but evil men and seducers shall wax worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived. And that deception will characterize the last days. And not only will it be people who are specifically out to deceive you, but it'll be people who they themselves are fooled. They think they have the truth, they think they know the way, and yet they're deceived, and therefore they're leading you astray. Evil men, seducers. And then as Paul told Timothy, but continue thou. You continue in the things you've learned and been assured of. And then he goes in to talk about the scriptures and how it's all scriptures given by inspiration of God. And Jesus and them, to them, warning them about the last day, said, you know, the first thing you need to do is you need to take heed and you need to be careful that you don't get deceived, because it's easy to get deceived. We are easily led astray. We don't have all the information. And yet, you know, the warning to Timothy was, be in the Word, be in the Scriptures, because they are the thing that'll keep you from being deceived. Continue thou in the things which you've learned. He says, for many shall come in my name, which is really a pretty brash statement when you think about it. Here's a guy on the outside, appears to be just a 30-something-year-old guy 2,000 years ago from an obscure little town, the son of a carpenter, And he's saying, in the last days, there will be a lot of people coming pretending to be me. It doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. But now looking back, you know, how many wackos are there every day that stand up thinking they're Jesus? I heard I was listening to some teachings, and I heard of Bob Coy was down in Florida, and he's got a massive church in Fort Lauderdale. It's like 30,000 people, some insanely huge church. And he was, you know, giving an altar call at the end and saying, you know, I really want to introduce you to Jesus Christ. Any of you need to come forward and want to be introduced to Christ. And as he's saying that, some woman comes down and walks up on the stage and stands next to him. And they're all like, you know, and he's like, can I help you? And she's like, well, you know, you want to introduce people to Christ, so I thought I'd come up and stand on the stage so people can meet me. Because she thought she was, apparently. And, you know, and there's any number of people who think they're the Christ. Interesting, when you look at what it says, many shall come in my name saying, I am. And then the Christ part is in brackets, literally just saying, I am, claiming to be God. As the Lord spoke out of the burning bush to Moses, he said, you know, I am that I am. And many will come in my name saying, I am, and the time draweth near. Go you not after them. And of course, you know, there are a lot of religions today. You've got the Moonies, some Sun Young Moon or whatever his name is, claims to be God. I used to work in a place in Philadelphia, and every day when I drove by, there was some poor girl out on the corner who was a Moonie selling flowers to support Reverend Moon, because apparently God needs the support of some girl selling flowers. And she, it was like on one of those little islands where two roads come by, and there's a little patch of grass, and there was a trail through the grass, worn down to the dirt, where she walked back and forth holding flowers. In the wintertime, there would be a trail through the snow, and she'd be out there every single day selling flowers to support her God, Reverend Moon. I mean, you know, David Koresh claimed to be God. The Mormons say you can be God. I mean, truthfully, that's what they believe. Their catchphrase is, you are, God was, and as God is, you can be. The idea that if you're a good enough Mormon, you get to be God of your own planet someday. Many will come saying, I am. Go you not there after them. He says, but when you shall hear of wars and commotions, be not terrified, for these things must first come to pass, but the end is not by and by. Then he said unto them, nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and great earthquakes shall be in diverse places, and famines and pestilences, and fearful sights and great signs shall there be from heaven. Some of the signs, some of the characteristics of the last days are going to be wars and commotions. Literally, commotions means instability or confusion. And, you know, we live in that world of instability and confusion. You know, I was very thrilled yesterday. I went to Bangor and filled up my gas tank, and the price of gas was actually down so that I could almost afford to do it. It was really, I was quite thrilled with it. But yet, we know that all it will take is one person in the Middle East tomorrow saying some brash statement about going to war, and phew, we'll be broke again. We can't afford to heat our house. I mean, the threat of war is so present and so real all the time. And it's interesting to me that he says, you know, look, that's going to happen. There will be, you'll hear about wars and commotions and instability, but be not terrified. You know, the scripture says in 2 Timothy 1:7, God has not given us the spirit of fear, but of power and of love and a sound mind. Isaiah says this in Isaiah 26:3, thou will keep him in perfect peace whose mind is stayed on thee, because he trusteth in thee. Trust ye in the Lord forever, for in the Lord Jehovah is everlasting strength. If you ever sit down and run through it, and I don't know about you, I spend a whole lot of my life, it seemed like a whole lot more, not as much now, just trying not to think, you know. Amusing. That's literally what we do. We amuse, and amuse means to muse is to think. Is not muse. And we spend so much of our time trying not to think about it. The temptation is so easy to go home and snap in a movie and just live in somebody else's little neat world that ends every 2 hours and is everything's cleaned up and all situations, you know, everybody who deserves to die does horribly and everyone who deserves to get together does magically. But when you stop and think, if you sit down and you look at the world around us and you see what's going on and you realize how perilous our life is, it's kind of a sobering thought. I mean, we And as Americans, we live in Disneyland. The rest of the world is not like we live. Understand that. You know, we were in the car yesterday, and the kids were hungry because we actually stretched them out an extra half an hour before we fed them. And I'm dying. And it's like, do you understand that there are some people in this world who the food you had for breakfast this morning would have to last them 3 days if they had that? And like, really? I just had two pancakes. Yes. Yeah, so they only get two pancakes every 3 days. Well, it's not necessarily pancakes, but the idea is the quantity, okay? You're missing the point here. The fact is there are a lot of people who just don't eat like we do. And we think that it's always going to continue just like it was. You know, I talk about this every once in a while, and as some of you guys know, back in the late 90s, there was that whole thing Y2K that was coming up. And as a computer programmer, I listened to some people, and I really started thinking about what would happen if the computer system shut down. What would really happen if suddenly, you know, the electrical grid went down? I mean, you look at any major city, and if they have a blackout for more than a few hours, the place goes nuts. If it happens overnight, there's looting, there's pillaging, there's rioting, and that's in one night. And when you sat down and you started looking through the scenarios of what could happen, you thought, oh my goodness. You know, I remember going, we used to make the trip back and forth to Philadelphia about a couple times a year anyways, and I remember going through when we had Abby, she was really young, and my wife was still nursing, and we'd have to stop every few hours so she could feed the baby, and we were traveling overnight. We stopped in New York, or outside of New York at a rest area. It was about 3 in the morning, and so the only people on the road were us and the trucks, and there's just going into the city, sitting in that rest area, there was literally thousands of semis going by me nonstop because it takes that much. It's not like, you know, there are farms inside of New York City. It is not like all of the things that people use and consume are manufactured there. They're all brought in. And you start thinking about what would happen if that went down. And when you start thinking about that, you start thinking, man, I got to do something. And so I kind of went heavy on one side, where, you know, we were prepared for, you know, let's just say I still have dried food at my house. I've used up all the toilet paper a long time ago. We're not, it's been probably 6 months now we've been buying sugar again and stuff like that. But, you know, we were like all prepared for this stuff to happen. And we had some friends that were more prepared than we were. And on one hand, you look at it and you think, If things are really going to happen, some people look at, you know, the end times and they read about the tribulation in Revelation and they think, man, I got to prepare and I got to get my shotgun and I got to get my rice and my beans and get up in the woods and buy a place in Maine. And you start thinking, you know, if you could really survive the wrath of God with rice, beans, and a shotgun, would it be all that significant, the tribulation? I don't think so. I think if, in the whole scheme of things, and I remember because it was in 99, we were really starting to prep, and that was about the time we started going to Calvary Chapel down in Bangor. And you know, that topic was coming up more and more, and they weren't overly concerned down there. Ken was really not, and I'm like, well, he's horribly mistaken, and he'll see I'm right. I don't feel any need to corrupt him. You know, I don't want to correct him because then he'll know I'll have stuff, and he could probably take me and come up and take my stuff, so I'm just not going to mention it, but man, they're going to see. You know, it was funny. I was listening as I was preparing for this to a tape by Joe Foch that he made back in 1998 when it was first really starting to be known that, and Joe Foch is a pastor in Calvary Chapel, Philly. 6,000-7,000 people in his church. And he was talking about what could happen and talking with people who were in his church who were programmers and they were heads of large businesses and the amount of money and time and effort they were spending on trying to get ready for the Y2K problem. And you know, so he actually formed this board in his church of people who were in the know and were preparing for this and seeing what was going to happen and how are they going to be prepared. And he's trying to think, what am I supposed to do as a pastor? And, you know, and so he calls Chuck Smith out in California. He says, Chuck, you know, have you heard about this whole Y2K thing? What are you doing to prepare? Are you doing anything to get ready? And Chuck says, yeah, I am. He says, what are you doing? I'm memorizing Psalm 46. This is Psalm 46. This is Chuck Smith's preparation for Y2K. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, will not we fear, though the earth be removed, and though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea, though the waters thereof roar and be troubled, though the mountains shake with the swelling thereof, Selah. There's a river. The streams whereof shall make glad the city of God, the holy place of the tabernacles of the Most High. God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. God shall help her, and that right early. The heathen raged, the kingdoms were moved. He uttered his voice, the earth melted. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge, Selah. Come, behold the works of the Lord, what desolations he hath made in the earth. He maketh wars to cease unto the end of the earth. He breaketh the bow and cutteth the spear in sunder. He burneth the chariot in the fire. Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the heathen. I will be exalted in the earth. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. Selah. And that Selah, if you don't know it, it's the Psalms are songs, and it's basically a musical pause for you to say, think about it for a minute. And he'll give a verse, and then he ends with, God of Jacob is our refuge. Think about it. You know, and for us, I mean, it's easy to get afeared. It's easy to get terrified. You know, when you think about what the capability militarily is now compared to what it used to be, it's unbelievable. And if you sat around and thought about it, and you realize that there are people who are trying to kill us because of who we are and what we believe, and they're doing everything in their power. And yeah, we saw what happened in 9/11 when they took out the towers. We saw that, and it was a horrible thing. But if you start doing the math and you think, well, what would happen if somebody touched off a small nuclear device in New York City instead of just taking down, you know, a couple buildings so that a large section of that city is uninhabitable and all of the technology that's routed through there and all of the financial districts and everything, the effects, when you really start thinking about it, are terrifying. It makes you glad that you live in the country and not in the city, because at least, you know, we have a pretty good shot if things get really bad of going out and shooting a deer or, you know, finding a dead possum on the road or something we can eat. Whereas in the city, there's nothing but, you know, cats and dogs. We're not called to be fearful. We're not called to be afraid. I mean, certainly it's prudent to prepare. We live in Maine. You know, power goes out all the time. I was down in Bangor last night. Power kept going out in a thunderstorm. Oh, well. You know, it's prudent to have a little bit on hand to feed your family and whatnot. But the truth is, our hope is not in rice and beans and shotguns. Our hope is in the Lord. You know, Romans chapter 8, verse 14 says, "For as many are led by the Spirit of God, they are the sons of God. You have not received the spirit of bondage again to fear, but have received the spirit of adoption, whereby we cry, Abba, Father." And in Philippians, he tells us, be careful for nothing. In other words, don't be anxious or really concerned, but in everything, by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known unto God. And the peace of God, which passeth all understanding, shall keep your hearts and minds through Christ Jesus. And you've probably heard me say, you know, there is a peace that comes with understanding. When I sit down to figure out my finances and I realize, you know, I can't, oh my gosh, I owe more than I got, you know, when you start figuring out all the details. And for me, as a guy, maybe, at least it seems like my wife thinks differently, maybe I'm stereotyping and you women are all different, but for me as a guy, I want to fix something. I find a problem, I fix it. She tells me I'm feeling whatever today, it's my job to fix that. That's what it is. And when I look at, you know, a financial problem, I say, well, I got to fix it. I got to know all the inputs. Okay, this is a math problem. I was good at math. I can do math. All right, here's all the pluses. That's a short column. Here's all the negatives. That's a big column. You know, and there is some peace in knowing all of the inputs and knowing what you have to work with and trying to come up with a plan on how I can do it. There is a piece that comes with understanding a problem. Until you get to a problem that's too big for you to figure out, or until you get to a problem where the negative side of the equation is way bigger than the positive side, at that point, you want the piece that surpasses the piece that comes with understanding. You want the piece that passes understanding, that comes from God, because there is a God who knows all of the inputs that I can't see. And he knows the sides of the equation, including the checks that are in the mail that I don't know about, and about the people who are going to leave a bag of food on my doorstep, and all the other things that he's going to work out. And there is a peace that comes from resting in a God who knows the big picture and sees the end from the beginning. And to face this world, you have to understand the majority of people in this world, Christianity is a small piece, evangelical Christianity is even a smaller piece than that. Most of the people are at the whim of their circumstances and are in fear. I remember you know, back in September 11th. I do you remember where you were? I mean, most of us weren't around when Kennedy was assassinated. We weren't around during Pearl Harbor. Our landmark event is, where were you when the towers got hit? I remember I was working, and I heard it. Somebody told me, went home at lunch, grabbed a TV, brought it back, and everybody in the office was riveted watching this TV. And I remember it was, I think it was, was it a Wednesday? It was either a Tuesday or a Wednesday, because on Wednesday at church down in Bangor, I was working in children's ministry. Normally my class was about, midweek class was about 15 kids, and we had about 75. We were, because all of a sudden when those towers got hit, everybody got religion in a hurry, and they were all back in church, and they wanted to know, what are we going to do? Is this the end? And the world is like that. Now, unfortunately, that was just for a season, and once they realized that there weren't fleets of planes crashing into Maine, they all sort of forgot about it and went back along their way. But as things continue to come up, people will be looking for an answer, and they'll be looking for peace because they won't have any. You know, and we're almost to that September 11th anniversary, and there are still tons of people trying to kill us and take us out for who we are and what we believe as a nation. And it's bad. You know, Jesus said in Matthew 24 in this section that if he hadn't returned, that if those days, the last days, weren't shortened, no flesh would be saved. And you think about some of those statements. There's a really good book I'm looking out for. You got it. He's going. There's a book that's coming out that talks about a lot of the technology statements in the Bible. Think about that particular one for a minute. If those days weren't shortened, no flesh would be saved. When we had the Civil War, which was, I think, for Americans, the bloodiest war, because everybody who died in that war was an American, nobody was really concerned about life on Earth ceasing. They weren't worried about the big musket going off, about the big cannonball dropping. I mean, it really was impossible. Now it's quite possible for us to wipe stuff out, you know. We talk about numbers and we talk about megatons and kilotons and all this, and I don't think you really understand the significance. In World War II, all of the firepower that was detonated, all the bullets, all the bombs, all the shells, including the two nuclear bombs that went off, all of the firepower that was expended by all sides in World War II adds up to about 3 megatons worth of explosive power. One Trident submarine has 24 megatons worth of stuff in it, or 8 World War IIs in one Trident sub. One sub could wipe out every major city on a continent easily, and we have 15 or 18 of those things out in the ocean. And if, you know, we now measure our arsenal in Earth increments, you know, well, we have a 3 Earth increment, means that we could blow up every square inch of the Earth 3 times, or a 4 Earth, you know, and when you start thinking about it, the idea that all life could be wiped out on the planet was not something they dealt with 100 years ago or 200 years ago. You know, nobody with bow and arrow was going to take out the world. It wasn't going to happen. But now, we all take it for granted how easy it is for everything to go off. And you understand why there are people who are chaining themselves to trees and whatever else, begging for peace, because they understand that, you know, we're at the mercy of some wacko. And now it's not just even us and the Soviets who are worried about destroying each other. We now are facing a completely different type of enemy, one who literally thinks that if they die killing you, they win. And that, you know, their religion says you will be one of their converts or you will die. Those are your only two options. And I heard somebody say on the radio the other day, where do you start negotiating with people whose starting point is your death? How do you do that? You just don't, you know. And so, when you're looking at that from a world perspective, it's cause for fear, it's cause for commotion, it's cause for terror. But yet, he says, "Don't be terrified. These things must come to pass, but the end is not immediate. Nation shall rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There'll be wars, and there have always been wars." He says there'll be other things. He says there's going to be great earthquakes. Shall be in diverse places, in famines, and pestilences. And fearful sights and great signs shall there be from heaven. And, you know, I found an interesting website last night. The internet is a great tool. Talking about some of the death tolls from various things, like what's mentioned in that verse throughout history. like we look at earthquakes. In 1556, there was one in China that killed 830,000 people. The second biggest one actually was the Indian Ocean earthquake and tsunami we just had in 2004, killed 287,000. China's had several, 250,000 people at a whack died, earthquakes. And you know, earthquakes, the question is, well, are earthquakes increasing? Is that the sign that Christ's about ready to come back? Now, in some places, he talks about it almost being like labor pains. And I remember being in with my wife through labor and delivery, which I pray I never have to do again because it's no fun, you know. She's going through literally earthquakes, and I've got a cup full of ice chips. That's my comfort. Honey, would you like an ice chip? I'm dying. You know, you did this to me. And it's, but watching that gauge, she's got the thing strapped on her stomach, you know, and it's got the little chart, little seismic register, the little mini seismic register, and watching that. And when it starts out, you know, when you first start experiencing labor pains, the first thing you get is way before you get those Braxton Hicks. And the first one comes, and she's like, ooh, I wonder what that was. You know, and it's just a little, ooh, that's weird. Oh, look, that's kind of neat, isn't it? You know, until you move into the delivery room, and then they start coming. And what happens is they increase in frequency and in intensity and in shorter intervals. And the fun thing about that little seismic chart that was strapped to her stomach, I could see them before she felt them. And all of a sudden, you know, I'd see that little thing start to go up on the digital readout, and I'd be like, and then, you know, and then all of a sudden the fingers would grip the sheets, and it would be like, you know, and it would be, and not that she screamed, I'm making, you know, she was real quiet and very pleasant, and, you know, you weren't in there, I was, and I'm not telling anybody anything, but the idea was, as it happened, as you got closer and closer to the moment of birth, it got more and more intense and more frequent. And that's the idea with earthquakes. And that's the idea with all of these things. They will increase over time. Can you look at any one short interval and say that there's more earthquake every year, there's got to be more and more? It didn't work that way with labor. It would get intense, and then it would tail off. And then it would get higher, and then it would tail off. And I think if you look historically over the last couple hundred years, the frequency of larger earthquakes is increasing. And that's one of the things that happens. I mean, they have numbers on this site of people who died from tropical cyclones. You know, you don't even think about that. But in Bangladesh in 1970, 500,000 people died from a cyclone. 500,000 people, one whack, gone. Floods and landslides. 1931 in China, they had a flood or a landslide where somewhere, and look at the range of this number, somewhere between 1 million and 3.5 million people died. And one flood. They have no. And think about, I mean, we saw the pictures, some of the pictures, they don't show us all the pictures, but some of the pictures from the tsunami when a couple hundred thousand people died. Imagine a flood where a couple million people, two or three times the state of Maine, all die in one day and are left heaped up, piled together by a flood. You know, it's crazy. And then he talks, besides the earthquakes in diverse places, he talks about famines. He talks about pestilences, which are diseases. Diseases, contractible diseases, smallpox in the 20th century, they estimate about 300 million people died from smallpox. In the bubonic plague, Black Death, from the 1300s up to the 1700s, they figure about 300 million people died from that. The Spanish flu in 1918, between 20 and 100 million people died. Can't even begin to imagine. Of course, that's the one that they say is real similar to the bird flu that everybody's worried about. AIDS worldwide from 1981 till now, about 25 million people have died from AIDS. And they've got various places. And then famines, people starving to death. In China for 3 years, they call it the period of three difficult years in China, from 1958 to 1961. And China didn't release the actual numbers, but they figure between 20 and 30 million people starved to death. 1907, 24 million people in China starved to death. Between 1932 and 1934, 5 million people in the USSR. 5 million in the Ukraine between 1921 and 1922. You know, you look, the Irish potato famine of 1846, 1,100,000 people starved to death. Ethiopian famine of 1984, 1 million people. The thing with the famine it says in parentheses after that, some of these famines may be partially or completely caused by humans. When the Ethiopian famine hit that I just said killed 1 million people, Israel offered to feed them, said, we will feed your people, we'll bring in the food. And the government, which was Muslim, said, we don't recognize you as a state. How can we accept food from people who don't exist? They didn't take it. 1 million people died. That's the kind of world we live in. If your hope isn't that this world will be a better place, that, you know, Michael Jackson and a bunch of stars can get together and sing, we are the world, we are the children, we can make it a better place, let's just hold hands and sing Kumbaya and it'll all get better. Sadly mistaken. And Jesus says that stuff is going to happen and it's going to continue and it's going to get bigger and bigger. And the people that we come into contact with every day, they don't have the hope we have. You know, the hope we have, Jesus said in Matthew chapter 10, verse 29, in the context of telling his disciples, don't be worrying about everything. He said, are not two sparrows sold for a farthing, penny? Two sparrows for a penny. In one of them shall not fall on the ground without your Father. But the very hairs of your head are all numbered. Fear ye not, therefore, for you are of more value than many sparrows. Again, the hairs of your head are numbered, not they're counted, not he knows you have 563,239 hairs, but when number 186,331 comes out in the brush, he knows which one went. I mean, they're numbered. He knows you that intimately. I don't know me that intimately. And yet, the Lord knows me. And we look at these big numbers of 100 million people, and sometimes it's tough to remember that these are people who love their children just like we do, who love their grandchildren just like we do, who want to provide for their family, who just want to have a happy life and sit on their porch, and yet because of where they happened to be born and the time they had, they faced horrible situations and scenarios where they had to watch their kids die, where they themselves died and couldn't provide for their kids. And yet we serve a God who says, I know you so intimately that I know how many hairs are on your head. That's the hope that we have. We're not called to be in fear. We're not called to prepare and try to save up and support ourselves through the trials. We're called to trust in our God. And he says, but before all these, in verse 12, they shall lay hands on you and persecute you. Little pep talk he's giving the boys here. Delivering you up to the synagogues and into the prisons, being brought before kings and rulers for my name's sake. But before all that happened, soon, and it was soon for them, and, you know, one of my favorite verses to quote, 2 Timothy 3:12, yea, and all that will live godly in Christ Jesus shall suffer persecution. Not on many people's refrigerator, but yet it is a promise, just like the rest of them, that part of following Christ includes suffering. And he says, and when that happens, in verse 13, it shall turn to you for a testimony, literally for a witness. And what's his instruction? He says, settle it therefore in your hearts, not to meditate before what you shall answer. For I'll give you a mouth and wisdom, which all your adversaries shall not be able to gainsay or resist. Settle it therefore in your hearts, not to meditate before what you shall answer. For me, usually when I'm talking to somebody about the Lord, I meditate after about what I should have answered. Like, oh, why didn't I just say this? If I'd have just said that, it would have been great and I'd have had him. Jesus is now, don't bother. In fact, don't even sit ahead of time and try to figure it out. You know, sometimes we have to go and confront somebody, or we know that we're going to have an opportunity to witness to somebody, and we start praying about it, and we get fearful ahead of time. Jesus says, don't worry about it. I'll give you a mouth. You know, Moses was the one who said, I can't speak. I don't have a mouth. He's going, your brother have a mouth? How about he speaks for you? You know, God will give you a mouth. If you need a mouth, might be somebody else's, might be your own. But just settle it in your hearts, because it's going to turn to you for a testimony. The point of suffering, whether it be the suffering that all of the world goes through because we live in a cursed world, or whether it's specifically because you are a Christian and you follow Christ, it will turn to you for a testimony at some point. And the testimony may be just how you bear up under it, whether you have peace or whether you have turmoil, whether you trust in your God or whether you turn to whatever other resources you can find. Jesus says, settle it. Settle it in your heart. Because, he says in verse 16, and you shall be betrayed both by parents and brethren and kinsfolk and friends, and some of you shall they cause to be put to death. And you shall be hated of all men for my name's sake. But there shall not a hair of your head perish. in your patience, possess you your souls. That almost seems contradictory at first. He says in verse 16, you'll be betrayed, and of you shall they cause to be put to death. Some of you will be put to death. But then he says in verse 18, not a hair of your head shall perish. And the reason why is physical death is not the same as perishing. You know, for those who teach that there is just death and then nothing, that's not true. You just move from one place to another. And the truth is, physical death does not equate perish. We have everlasting life. You know, and we have to realize that. And we look at any situation we come into, we will be persecuted for knowing the Lord. There are people who will hate you specifically because you have Christ living in them. And just the witness of Christ in your life is enough to convict them of their sin. Remember what Jesus said in John 15:18. He says, if the world hate you, you know that it hated me before it hated you. If you were of the world would love his own, because you're not of the world. But I have chosen you out of the world. Therefore, the world hates you. Remember the word that I said unto you, the servant's not greater than his Lord. If they've persecuted me, they will also persecute you. If they've kept my saying, they'll keep yours also. But all these things will they do unto you for my name's sake, because they know not him that sent me. If I had not come and spoken unto them, they had not had sin, but now they have no cloak for their sin. And just the fact that God is in you and the witness of the Holy Spirit is convicting them of their sin, people will be upset with that. People will hate you. They'll despise you. They'll look for a hole. They'll look for you to fail. Jesus, don't be surprised. But the thing to remember is what John said later on in his life in 1 John chapter 2, verse 17. He says, and the world passes away in the lust thereof, but he that doeth the will of God abides forever. You know, the disciples, when they heard that the temple was going to be destroyed, that this immense structure that was the crowning jewel of their society was just going to be ripped apart so there wouldn't be any trace of it left, they figured it was the end of the world, and they wanted to know what to do and what were the signs going to be. And Jesus gives them a few signs, and we're going to go into next week more about what happened specifically with the siege of Jerusalem. But he says, don't be concerned about wars and rumors of wars. Don't be worried about the earthquakes and the famines and the pestilences. Don't even be worried when they start delivering you up. And when you look through the testimony, you go to Fox's Book of Martyrs and you look at the early church and what happened to all of the disciples gave their life except for John, and he was boiling oil. He just was a fryer, not a boiler, apparently, and so he didn't die. But all of them were put to death, a lot of them quite horribly, for their faith. And yet, they all understood that this world is passing away, and it's just a temporary thing. My wife was watching, she rented the other night, was it The Point of the Spear? End of the Spear, about Jim Elliot and Elizabeth Elliot's husband and Nate Sane, I think, and a couple of the guys who went over to try to win this tribe. And I didn't watch the movie because I wasn't ready to be emotionally involved in. I knew what it was going to take. And I'm like, I can't do this. But she watched it. She's like, it was so inspirational, you know. And the fact that they were going to witness these people and they got out of the planes and they had guns. And one of them asked, are you going to shoot them if they come? And the guy said, no, I'm not going to shoot them, because if they kill me, and I'm paraphrasing because I didn't watch it, I know where I'm going. I'm ready to meet Jesus. But they don't know him and they're not ready to go. You know, and I do know one of the quotes attributed to Jim Elliot is, he said, he is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. You know, and again, let me encourage you. This world is passing away. And if you don't know the Lord, if you are trying to navigate these waters by yourself, you're nuts, because this world is crazy. And you don't know from one moment to the next when everything will change. And yet, if you have a relationship with the God who holds it all in the palm of his hand and knows the end from the beginning, you don't have anything to fear. There is a peace that comes from knowing God is in control. And if you don't know him, let me encourage you. Come up and see me afterwards. We can pray and you can start a relationship with the God who made you and who is intimately involved in your life. If you do know him, let me encourage you with what Jesus said. Settle it therefore in your hearts. You know, in your patience, possess you your souls. He said, patience, your endurance, possess, it means acquire or gain. And souls, it's life. And we are to be in possession because we have had our lives given back to us. God made us born again if you've accepted Christ and you are alive. And so our role is not to be caught up and concerned in whether it be the terror of our finances or the terror of our messed up relationships or the terror of our job situation or the terror of our insufficiency at school or the terror of living in a nation that's at war. But it's to be trusting in the God who knows the end from the beginning. So if that's you, settle it in your heart. Let's do what Timothy was exhorted to do. Continue in the things which we've learned and know who we've learned them from. Be men and women of the word. Amen? Let's pray. Lord, thank you so much that you're a God who is not willing that any would perish, but all would come to know you. I pray, Lord, if there's anyone here who doesn't know you, they won't leave that way. They won't go out and face this insecure world alone. Lord, I pray that you would help us all to have an answer, be able to give an answer for the hope that we have. Lord, and give us your peace. Help us to settle in our hearts, to trust you and follow you. Lord, I pray you would bless my brothers and sisters as they go. Give them opportunity to be witnesses, Lord, to share the hope that they have. Lord, please keep them, I ask, in Jesus' name.